The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, along with a man who thinks of Don Mattingly before Michael Jordan when you say the number 23. That's Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Welcome to another edition, and we have a great guest today in Cornell head wrestling coach Rob Cole. We're going to have a lot of fun today.
We always have fun, Kyle.
We have a lot of fun, but Rob kind of allows you to take it to another level. I just think Rob has a unique perspective that no other coach has, and I hope we get to tap into that on this show.
I'm guessing we will.
I think we will.
I'm confident.
A lot of history there with his program. They're doing well. A lot of guys that are really fun to watch, and I think Cornell is a program that you want to see at the NCAA championships.
Yeah, for sure. Yanni Diakamahalis having a tremendous freshman season. Same with Ben Darmstadt at 197 pounds, a guy that's a little bit unorthodox, tall, wiry, super tough on top, getting better and better. He's a handful, and Cornell's got a lot of good things going right now from the standpoint of having, you know, dynamic, young superstars on that roster.
We have to do some housekeeping here, some house cleaning. We went through our most exciting wrestlers last week, and we forgot a couple.
I thought you were talking housekeeping about what my office looks like, where we're recording, here. Makeshift office with cables everywhere.
Yeah, and well, it's what we do.
Clutter.
Get on the mat, on the air. But, hey, we forgot Zahid Valencia.
We didn't forget about him.
Well, we didn't. We forgot to mention him. We remembered him. But
we ran out of names, right?
No, we got to 10, but he should be near the top. He should have been one of ones at Arizona State. And they have the Pac-12s coming up, which only has five teams right now. But we got to mention that guy. I mean, what a fun wrestler to watch. And another guy that's just unique in his execution and a lot of moves that you just don't typically see in wrestling. Boy, you want to watch him at any tournament. He's a guy that when his name gets called, you want to go see him wrestle.
Yeah, certainly high-level offense and really smooth and slick finishes. Guy that, you're not going to see a whole lot of holding back with Zahid.
Got to go through our philosophy. I know we have mirror philosophies on this, and that's with dual meets. And of course, with a dual meet, if you win a match, you get a certain amount of points for your team. If you lose a match, you get zero. That's just the automatic there. I don't like it. You don't like it. I think our solution has been just count the team points. Just tabulate the team points. The most you can get for a technical fall now with a four-point near fall is 19. I think if you get to 14, then you get a four-point near fall and you get the riding time. I think you can bump up to 19 for that. Give 20 points for a fall. Of course, the critics are going to say that means you can win 9 matches and still lose the dual meet. I say I don't care because those matches still count for the seeding. This is about what the dual meet score is going to be, and if the pin is the ultimate, let's do some interesting things with the dual meets. Right now, there is no dual meet championship. They don't amount for a lot. So let's go out there and have some fun. Let's tabulate it. Let's get some basketball-type scores. Let's generate some interest.
Absolutely. And this really struck me in 2013, coming home from the national duels up in Minneapolis, where the crowd wasn't all that great for other reasons. The Minnesota State qualifiers were that same weekend, but it made me think a lot about dual meets and the future of our sport. And we saw a lot of instances that weekend where guys would be up 2, 3, 4 points in the final period and, just holding position. And you think about it now, somebody's up 4-1, and really, what's the incentive in the final minute? I mean, you gotta get a takedown and a turn to, get your major. And to me, a 8-1 win with 4+ minutes of riding time should not be, you should be rewarded more for that than you should if, we go to 11 minutes and I have 1 second more of riding time than you.
No doubt. And that's the other thing is that only one person gets to score for your team, regardless of how close they are in talent level. And you're, example of winning 8-1, that's way more impressive. You're just a point away from a major decision, and in the way it's formatted now, that's way more impressive than two guys that battle it out, and it might be the 3-2 variety or even 9-8. But let's just tabulate that. It still doesn't matter. You're still going to win matches. The winner is still going to be the winner of the individual match. That's still going to count for seeding at the conference tournaments or the NCAA championship. So why not just have some fun with dual meets and just let it ride? Let's get some big scores. And yeah, fans are going to be more engaged too, because they're going to look at it, what the score is going to be. Just keep it tabulated.
Well, yeah, I think we'd see so much more. We'd see so much more attacking, entertaining wrestling. You know, when guys know that, you know, you can really put some big numbers up there that can highly impact the team standing, team race, you know, the team dual score. You know, the other thing to me too is, like, we've changed criteria so much in recent years. And, you know, it comes down to late in a dual meet and people are sitting there in the stands or sitting there at home knowing that, all right, if my team wins by three, like even Penn State, Ohio State, right? I mean, you know, how many does Snyder actually have to win by, you know, for Ohio State to win the duel? Now, I don't know, you know, especially if you're watching it in a bar and you haven't seen the whole duel meet and you're not sitting there, you know, on your phone keeping track of individual scores, you don't know. You don't know what he needs. If he needs if he wins by major, is Ohio State going to win the duel on criteria, or does he need to win by tech, or what was it? I think 12 or 13 is what he ultimately had to win by. But it's, you know, I think from a fan standpoint, like if you could attach a point value to a fall, I don't know what that would be, 25 maybe.
I was thinking in my head it would be 20 for a fall, because the most you could get for a technical fall would be 19. So just,
what if you took the technical fall out, the match termination out?
Well, I don't like technical falls anyway.
Remember when Satiev,
I like that.
Remember Satiev at the World Championships where he got taken down right away and then he went past the tech, wanted to keep wrestling and beat the guy from some African country like 34-2?
That's one of my great moments in wrestling. I love that moment at the World Championships in 03 in New York City. I love that. That was awesome. But with that being said, hey, we got to throw data in here, because there were three dual meets that I broke down using this format. So
okay,
Missouri is undefeated this year in duels. They won against UNI 23-9. Seems like a blowout. But if you go with actual team points, or actually match points, it was 81-52. So still you see a big gap there, but that's 81-52. Ohio State beat NC State. Two quality teams here. Ohio State is really good, and so is NC State. They're in the top 5-6 right in there. They won 29-6. If you go match points, 102-38. That's domination. That is more indicative of how dominant they were in that particular duel meet. And then you take Iowa versus Iowa State. They won 35-6. It'd be 100-47. So if you look at the way it is now, it would look like Iowa was the most dominant, but no. Ohio State, even though it was a 29-6 dual meet score, given what it is today, they were the most dominant team of the weekend, other than Penn State, who wins 55-0 over Buffalo. But that's a little deceptive. But Ohio State beating NC State, a quality program, 102-38 as far as just match points. That's a nice win for Ohio State.
Absolutely.
And yeah, they look good.
Yeah, for sure. And I think Joey McKenna's win, you know, get that's big for him going into March to post a victory like that over Kevin Jack, come out, score in the opening seconds. And boy, when he scores early, he's really hard to beat. But I think that's really positive for Ohio State. I think, you know, just watching some of those matches unfold, you know, they gave up some early scores in some of those matches, but guys came back and really finished matches strong for the most part. There were a couple hiccups in there, but by and large, I think you if you're an Ohio State fan, you have to be pleased with pretty much not everything, but a lot of what you saw on Sunday.
Is Michigan the team that's flying under the radar right now that could sneak up on people?
Maybe a little bit. In that, you know, they came into the season and they looked like a team that could be, you know, obviously Penn State, Ohio State have kind of separated themselves from the pack, you know, for months now, at least on paper. And then they've backed it up on the mat. Michigan felt to me like a team that was a strong contender for that number three spot coming in. And then, you know, you come in a season and Pantaleo gets off to a bit of a rough start, and Micić goes through some things early in the season where dropped a couple matches out in Vegas, got majored by Austin DeSanto. You know, got handled in the All-Star Classic by Seth Gross. But ever since that first weekend in December, he's caught fire. He's been really impressive. Took it to Luke Pletcher here in the dual meet about a week and a half ago. And so I think the Wolverines are certainly trending upward right now. And, you know, you look at it, if they can get Massa back on track and back to where he was a year ago at the end of the season, you know, you got some serious firepower, you know, several guys in there in that mix that could make the finals and win titles.
How about Arizona State? Where are they going to shake out in this mix? An interesting team because they do have the firepower, and a lot of it's just going to hinge on how some of those guys that maybe you aren't expecting get up in the national tournament hunt and place high. It's going to be interesting to see where they come out. I don't know if they're a trophy team yet, but they're on the borderline right now.
Well, you got the guy, you know, we mentioned Zahid and, you know, national championship potential there. They've got some other guys that, you know, Jason Sertzis is one that comes to mind. I mean, what, you know, high end potential is there. We saw him win a national title as a freshman at Northwestern and then go through some hardships and have to transfer to recover this last year of eligibility. And, you know, he gets the year of eligibility back and then he's not even the starter from part of the season. And coming down the stretch here has won the job, it appears. But a guy that hard to score on and gives himself a chance in a lot of matches. You know, what's his ceiling at 149 pounds? I mean, obviously Zane has separated himself from the pack, but Sertzis has been in there with a lot of other guys at that weight class. And Anthony Valencia is a guy that I'm really intrigued to see. You know, a guy that has freestyle wins over Isaiah Martinez, a super talented guy in freestyle, hasn't quite manifested itself yet in the college ranks. You know, I don't know that he is tapped into his full potential yet, but the upside is there. And same with Ryan Milhoff, a guy that was an All-American at Oklahoma, transfers out after Mark Cody leaves there and resurfaces at Arizona State. So I think that there's a lot of guys that, you know, fall into that mix that are teetering right on the brink of, you know, whether they'll be on the podium or not. And so I think it's a team with a pretty wide variance there that, you know, you take Zahid out of the question or out of the equation. You know, they don't have a lot of automatics after that, guys that you would say, all right, this guy for sure is going to be an All-American. But that being said, they have a lot of guys in that lineup that, you know, if you look up in Cleveland, they've got 7-8 All-Americans, and they catch fire. That wouldn't be totally unexpected either.
It's amazing that we're talking about lineups and what the potential could be for some of the power programs at this point. Penn State and Iowa still have some lineup questions. For Iowa, it's 141 and 174. Tom Brands has said he's going to make a decision soon. But as we both look at what those might look like, who are you thinking at 141, 174? If you had to pick right now, who's going to be in the lineup for Iowa?
I would guess that they'll go with the guys that they went with on Sunday, which would mean Vince Turk and Joey Gunther. But, you know, it just seemed that listening to Tom's post-match comments, that's, you know, trying to decode his language, it sure seemed like that was the take that I got from it. Now, I don't know that they've completely closed the door on it, but, you know, he hasn't been a wrestle-off guy. You know, he likes to determine things in competition and let it shake out. Carter Happel kind of put himself back in the mix a little bit, I thought, with that pin over Tommy Thorne. But Turk has certainly wrestled well the second half of this season. You know, he had the high-scoring win against Sal Profaci. He was competitive in the match against Nick Lee, scored some takedowns in that match. Looked really good on Sunday against Ian Parker with a major decision win there. So I don't know that he has really opened the door back up for Carter Happel to charge through it and take that spot from him. And then, you know, I don't know. 74 is interesting. Gunther is a guy that is really hard to score on. Maybe doesn't have the most high level offense, but usually finds himself in matches against most guys. I mean, he's gotten handled a couple times by some of the higher level guys at that weight class, but by and large, he gives himself a chance in most matches. So that would be my guess. What are you thinking?
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm heading right now. I think that you probably are going to go with the guys that you wrestled at Iowa State in the last dual meet of the year. And I think you give them the opportunity to earn their spot and say, hey, these are the guys we're probably going with, and they're going to give us data on the direction we're going to go. And I think they prove themselves worthy, and I think that's the direction they're going to go. 197 for Penn State's a little bit different, too, though, because who's going to shake out there? That's also interesting because you have two quality guys that have had marquee wins across the board, and that's going to be tough for Cal on who he's going to pick there too.
Good problems, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't.
You got two, three guys there. I mean, McCutcheon hasn't been in the lineup, much this season at all, if at all. I know he's wrestled at some open tournaments, but Shakur Rashid, Anthony Kassar have been dynamite the second half of the season.
Oklahoma State, we got to make sure we mention them. Are they going to have an individual NCAA champion? They've had one in Dean Heil the last couple years, has lost, I think, four matches now. Who's the guy there that's going to lead the charge for the Cowboys?
That's a good question. I mean, they're kind of, when I talk about Arizona State and how many All-Americans they could have teetering there, you could probably say the same thing about Oklahoma State with national champions. But Cade Brock has a lot of ability, a lot of offense, a lot of ways to score points, but he hasn't been able to crack the code with Seth Gross yet. And Seth Gross seems like he has separated himself from the pack at 133. At least he has to this point in this season. So that's a tough one there. Dean Heil, we have not seen the Dean Heil of old this year. Talked about at length over the course of his 55 match winning streak that he was, kind of playing with fire there a little bit, but, all those close matches have caught up to him this year, and he hasn't been able to find a way to get his hand raised time and time again. And I think that gives a lot of other people confidence going out there against him. It's not like, he has never been like Zane Rutherford where, Zane goes out and crushes hope and, you walk off the mat thinking, how in the world am I going to beat this guy? And Dean Heil has let people hang around in matches. I think one of their best opportunities right now, I think maybe you look at their best chance for a national champion. I think it's Preston Weigel at 197 pounds, because we saw at the beginning of the year, it felt to me at the beginning of the year like there was Colin Moore and then there was everybody else. You had Jared Haught that was, ranked second, and Colin Moore's pinned him twice. You got Willie Miklas after that. But he, Willie won by fall against Jared Haught, but he was losing most of the match. And felt like there were tiers, and Colin Moore was on a tier by himself. And then there were a bunch of other guys in like the next tier of like 3, 4, 5 guys. And then, from then on down to about 17, 18 seemed like it was pretty even. Well, now 197 is an absolute mess to rank or seed. And you look at who might win it, and I think you have to consider Preston Weigel a strong contender.
A guy we haven't mentioned much, and we got to make sure we talk about what his senior year is going to look like. That's Isaiah Martinez at 165, two-time NCAA champ. Yeah. Set the world on fire his freshman year at 157. Just really was that guy that was explosive, and maybe we haven't seen as much of that lately, but still a guy that could win his third NCAA championship, be a four-time finalist.
With two career losses, right?
Yeah, two career losses. It's pretty remarkable, but you got a couple tough guys, Marinelli and Joseph, that might be standing in his way. So I still am banking on him winning the NCAA championships this year. He's still that good, but there's going to be some tough competition for him to get to the end game and get to that goal of being a three-timer.
Yeah, David Mercatani and I were talking about this last week on Weighing In, how as you mentioned, you rattle off all his credentials, and we haven't hardly talked about him at all this year on Weighing In. But I think you know, one of the reasons we haven't is just the way the circumstances have played out, you know, with Illinois schedule, with, you know, the way things worked out. When Illinois wrestled Imar, Marinelli wasn't ready yet. He was hurt. Illinois wrestles Nebraska, and Imar doesn't get a chance to face Isaiah White. Illinois wrestles Rutgers, and I think Richie Lewis might have been sick at the time. So any chances that he's had for a marquee matchup, they just haven't materialized this year. Imar wasn't at Midlands. It's just a really weird set of circumstances how the schedule has played out, and we haven't seen him in a ton of marquee matches this year. And it's even stranger in the fact that Big Ten is so loaded at 165 pounds that it hasn't happened. But, you know, I'm looking forward to 165 in East Lansing the weekend after this one, because that's going to, I think the fur is going to fly. It's going to be awesome. There's going to be, what do we got, like 8-9 guys that are all-American caliber wrestlers. So, you know, quarters, semis, and finals there are going to be bonkers.
We're bringing in our first guest, Rob Cole, head wrestling coach at Cornell University. He was an NCAA champion for North Carolina in 1988. Also made a world team in 1990. And, Rob, you are now one of the elder statesmen. I think we were looking, you are number two behind John Smith as far as seniority. How does that feel for you?
Oh, my God. I never in a million years would have imagined that, to be honest with you. I would have said, I'm still one of the young up-and-coming coaches, so I'm not going to accept that.
It is interesting, though. I mean, you and John Smith graduated the same year in 88, and now you guys are leading the charge. How much longer do you want to go, another 20 years?
Well, and you got to admit, I mean, look, you look at John, you look at me. That guy, crusty old bastard, looks like he's been at it since he's been, you know, for the last 50 years, whereas I'm spry. You know what I mean? I mean, I got to go longer than John. I got to be at some, for one point in my life, I have to be the oldest reigning coach. I want to be Gary Taylor. You know what I mean? Gary Taylor, Jack Childs. That's what I want to be when I grow up.
But, hey, when you win 6 world and Olympic championships in a row, that's going to take a little bit of a toll.
Yeah, well, I guess I've tried to get a hold of him the last month. You know, he doesn't call back, so I'm going to blame too many blows to the head for his inability to pick up the phone. But yeah, no, I love John. He's done an amazing job, and I just got to get him to retire before I can ever even consider that stuff.
Well, the obvious question here, being one of the elder statesmen, that you started in 1993 as the head coach at Cornell, what's been the biggest change in coaching since that time?
I mean, I can't speak to other programs. I mean, obviously, I can speak to my program, what the biggest change is, and that's just the support. Our program has changed administratively at every level. I remember when I came in with Jack Spaeth, who, by the way, I think was one of the greatest coaches. He doesn't get enough recognition. He really helped us. He's really the guy who put Cornell wrestling on the map. When I came in with Jack, and we would recruit 100 plus 150 kids. And when I mean recruit them, I mean full bore recruit them. And then Cornell would let us get these kids. We'd probably get them to, you know, get 36, 40 full applications. That's before the common application. So they're all writing full applications, which took a lot of work. We'd submit the names and you would know who's going to get in. And then Cornell would decide who to get in with. They might take 5 125 pounders and 5 heavyweights, but not the guys you need. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, they'd tell you what their financial aid was. So it was just crazy. And you had to recruit so many more kids. Now there's a little bit more certainty to it. And so you can really focus on a better kid and take the time to recruit to try to get those top kids. And so for me, that was probably one of, you know, the biggest difference as far as how I apply my time, because it's, you know, when you're spending that much time recruiting just to get minimal results, you know, it's killing you. You're up till 2 o'clock in the morning trying to recruit kids. How do you get up and then work with these kids all day long? So that was a huge change. Obviously the regional training center world has changed the face of wrestling as well. I don't know if it's better or worse. I know it's also just created that has supplanted the time commitment. So now you're raising money for regional training centers as opposed to, you know, for me personally, wasting time chasing my tail recruiting. So it's always something different, but I would say that probably for me, you know, for at least at Cornell, it's the whole administration piece and the regional training center.
What has social media done to recruiting?
I mean, I don't know what it's done for the act of recruiting. At the end of the day, you still need to get in front of kids, and they need to, you know, like you. You know, kids come to Cornell or Oklahoma State or North Carolina or any place because, quite honestly, they develop a relationship with the coaches. And you're not going to get a piece. You know, you're going to hopefully be able to project who you are and what your program stands for through social media. But that's really not, that's just a little extra. That's nothing. I don't think it's that big a difference that, when it comes to building your program. As far as causing grief to a coach, you know, that's a different story. You know, we've had some knuckleheads on our team in the past who were social media hounds who were out on, you know, on Facebook, not anymore, but more Instagram and Twitter and all the different the younger platforms. You know, hey, I'm a MySpace guy. You know what I mean? I mean, so or MySpace generation. But you know, you got to be careful. You know, you put something out there. You know, you got to be careful. It projects upon everyone else on your team. But I don't think it has made a team better or worse for that matter. So for me, it's just one more nuance or nuisance, if you will.
We used to get the opportunity to see you at the national duels. We're here in Cedar Falls, Iowa. You used to get to see you at the Unidome. Do you miss the national duels at all, Rob?
I do. I love the national duels. It kind of created we had a little tradition. There were, you know, certain friends I made. You know, I remember going to a little restaurant at the in Waterloo, and I remember meeting a good buddy from Iowa State and a good buddy from they're good buddies from who went to Iowa State and one who went to West Point of all places, who have become good friends through that program. I mean, through that tournament. Had nothing to do with Cornell fans, but it was just this tradition. And every year, our fans would, you know, hop in the car or airplane and get out there. And I thought it was growing. But, you know, I understand coaches don't want to go out there and have that kind of competition that late in the year always. But, you know, I loved it. It was a chance for us to wrestle some schools like in Iowa or Penn State. It's very, very difficult for us to get those guys on the schedule. If we don't have a tournament like that, the likelihood of us scheduling a Penn State or an Iowa is almost nil, unfortunately.
What's the resolution for that? What can we do to get that type of tournament back into college wrestling? Because it's gone right now.
Well, there's nothing. You can't get the coaches to agree on anything. So that's going to have to be mandated by somebody who has more authority than the coaches. And that's a plain and simple answer.
All right. As far as your season right now, we're talking about dual meets. The South Beach duels seemed like it was a big success. What's the future of that look like?
They're going to do it again next year, same time, same, not the same location. It'll be at the Fort Lauderdale Convention Center, which is a beautiful place right on the water. I loved it. We spent 9 days down there as a team. It was a great opportunity for us to, you know, I don't love the snow, but it was the coldest snap of the entire winter. I know because my wife would send me pictures of zero or sub-zero temperatures. And then it was like 75 to 80 in South Beach. We had such a long break at Cornell. We didn't come back till January 22nd to school. So if we had come home, we spent a month doing 2 days. It just drags the season on. As it was, we're still working hard. We get up in the morning. We get a good hard wrestling practice in. And we go to the beach and we train on the beach. We're doing sprints. We're swimming. The team stayed in one house, one beautiful. We got a massive house that we had 22 guys in the house. They've got a pool. They've got a basketball court. So it was a great team building experience, as opposed to here. If they were in Ithaca, they're working out, they're going home, going back to bed, watching TV until the next practice. And it was just a different experience. I will certainly do it again. The feedback was positive. I think we've got a lot of other teams that want to do it again next year. I know they do. We need to build on the additional match feature, which we did this year. With the last day, we just lined the guys up and they all counted for the RPI. We need to do that each day so that coaches can get more matches for their guys. And I don't see any reason why anybody wouldn't want to go there unless it's more expensive.
Hey, Rob, as you look at that thing and you mentioned getting, you know, your extra guys more matches and taking it to the Fort Lauderdale Convention Center, what other things do you think might be able to be tied in with it to take what's a pretty good event already in year one and make it even better?
Excuse me. There's a huge wrestling community down there. I think that doing what like the Virginia Duels did when they have a sponsor. I remember going to Virginia Duels and one year we went on a sub, a nuclear sub, another one went on an aircraft carrier. We did some pretty neat things in general vicinity. I know we have a Cornell Alumni Association. I mean, it's a huge retirement community. Each school should have a large alumni association in that area. For me, I'm going to get ahead of it this year. Make sure that one day in between our practices, you know, we can go out on the Everglades and do a fan boat or whatever, maybe take them deep sea fishing, not at the cost of wrestling, not at the cost of training. I want to do that in addition to little things like that, that can just more team building. I mean, I know my family will be down there. I know we had a lot of parents that spent their vacation down there. So, you know, the kids are still training, but they can be around with their family. And there's no reason we can't make our sport more enjoyable for these kids and their families. It doesn't have to be drudgery. It doesn't have to be all Spartan training. We're still going to have the same kind of level of training, and people criticize it. It's remarkable when people almost mock me. Like, oh man, yeah, you just want to make it fun. I'm like, yeah, I do. I want to enjoy my experience with the wrestling and the kids, but I also want to have that high level wrestling and high level training. The two are not mutually exclusive. I still remember watching the University of North Carolina playing a basketball game in Atlantis, you know, the resort. And I thought, oh my God, now we're not doing that because it's cost prohibitive. But now with Airbnbs, it's really not that expensive. We have the kids, instead of flying back to Ithaca, they fly back to meet us in Fort Lauderdale. And then we just do a one way back home. It's not the cheapest time of the year to get flights down there. So that's one to one additional expense. But once you're there, you know, if you get a housing, it's pretty good. And we had a couple different nights. We had alumni pick up meals for the kids. So we were able to defer some costs that way. You know, a lot of it's just planning.
One of the guys that I think of when you think about fun, it's Damian Hahn, your head assistant coach. How did you snag him? How did you get him to come to Cornell?
Oh my golly, I don't remember, to be honest with you. That's 12, 13 years ago. As you recall, you mentioned I'm one of the oldest coaches out there.
That's true.
So you have to forgive my memory. I don't remember. It wasn't rocket science. He was a very prolific athlete, college wrestler, college athlete, and he was on the top of his game at the international level as well. And I just know he had a big personality and outgoing, gregarious. It wasn't a hard choice.
Now that you have him in the program, you have to know that at some point he's going to want to have a head coaching position. How do you kind of manage that, knowing that he's your assistant coach now, but it's going to be looking?
Well, when anybody calls on him, I slander him basically, you know, so I do. It's amazing. It's amazing how easy it is, you know, so that's one trick. Two, you know, I mean, Izzy said, I'm old as dirt, so I'm not going to be here forever either. So, but he's got a family and he's got to make those decisions for himself. But I certainly don't ever try to keep anybody here if they have a better opportunities. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of is that we have guys who've gone on from Cornell. And I think in some small manner, we've been able to help them in their careers. You know, unfortunately, you know, Brian Smith has started off here at Cornell, cut his teeth at Cornell with Jack Spates as well. And you know, now we can't beat him. So unfortunately, taking what we did here and then added a whole bunch of his own twists to it and made it better. We need to find a way to catch up to him now and knock him off here the next couple of years.
You've taken all sorts of upper weights, different sizes, shapes, and turned them into big time winners. What has enabled Damian to connect so well with those guys and for you guys to have so much success in the upper weights?
Well, one, you just create an environment where the kids enjoy being in the wrestling room. You know, I mean, and you work them hard, but they come back wanting more because they enjoy my coaches. I see coaches who surround themselves. I see some, and I'm not naming names because I don't want these guys to hate me, but there are some coaches out there, pretty grumpy sons of guns, and they surround themselves with other guys who just like them. And, you know, I don't want to be in a room. I don't want to be in that environment. You know, so why are you going to go work out with people you don't like? You know, and I see some of these coaches who are screaming and barking and yanking the kids and doing things that's just like, I've never had a wrestler walk who goes on the mat trying to lose. And sometimes I think these coaches forget how good we weren't. And they think that, you know, they're infallible. And it just mind numbing that these guys would, you know, the second the kid loses a match, they're screaming at him and belittling him as if the kid tried to do it intentionally to punish the coach. It's just mind numbing. And I know as an athlete, the coach treats me like that, I'm not going to react very favorably. And I'm certainly not going to want to go and work with that guy. So, you know, my coaches they're intelligent and they're very compassionate and they push the kids hard. And because they're like that and they've developed an extremely positive rapport, kids want to work harder and they want to be in there. And because they want to be in there, they are in there more. And of course, the harder you work, the better you get. So it's not really simple. It's not a very complicated formula.
Kyle Dake may have the most impressive credential, and that's winning 4 NCAA championships at 4 different weights. Now that you are a few years removed from that and you get a chance to reflect on Kyle Dake's career, what allowed him to be able to create maybe the most impressive statistic in all of college wrestling?
Well, Kyle was a real scientist, I mean, real to the sport. He didn't just go in every day and go through the motions. He had a game plan every single day. He wanted to get a little bit better. Every single day, his mantra was 1% better. Now, obviously, it wouldn't take very long to get a lot better at that level. But, you know, if it's 0.1% every day, you know, that was his attitude. And so many times these kids go in, they don't have a game plan. Kyle had a very regimented program where he knew what he needed to work on, and he worked on it every single day. And he's continued to do that. He's had a few injuries that have set him back a little bit, but that's pretty much the nature of the beast when you're dealing with this sport. And he also was gifted with an inordinate amount of natural ability. He's flexible. He's strong. He's powerful. So he's kind of like the perfect little wrestling machine.
How much did his parents factor into that? And hearing him talk about his parents, it sounds like his mom was exceedingly positive. Did you see that on a day-to-day basis from his mom?
Well, people ask me what the secret to success is. And I said, in wrestling or life, because it's the same answer, it's parents. There are certain exceptions to the rule, but if you look at all of our All-Americans and national champions, every single one of them had a mother and a father actively involved in their life up until a certain point in their life, for a longer than short period of time. One exception to that rule is Nashawn Garrett, but he also had, you know, he had a great, very strong coach, and he had other things that buoyed him through that kind of that rough part. But almost without exception, it's a strong family background. Now people can get upset about me with me because I said they don't want me to talk about, you know, divorce and things like that. And, you know, better for the kid. No, it's better for you. And you don't like it. That's fine. But you know, that's the truth is, whether you like it or not, kids are going to do better when they have a mother and a father in their life. And it just drives me crazy when people want to fight me on that, because, you know, I don't even fight them because I think you're just being selfish. Now, if it's abusive or something, it's like there are, as I said, there are exceptions to every rule, but it's pretty simple. And when I recruit the parents, I bring the parents in. I meet with the parents. If I don't like the parents, I don't recruit the kid. And there have been some really good kids, and people say, no, don't blame the kid for the parents' fault. But the reality is, I'm bringing in a kid, 30 other guys, 30 plus other kids. I don't want to subject them to risk. And so the easiest key to our success is to bring in kids who come from good families. And Kyle is a direct reflection of that. Parents are some of the most wholesome, down to earth people. They're tough on them, but they're very, very very loving, very supportive, and that is really, you know, if you want to, you want the easiest answer, how to develop a great wrestler, have great parents. It's obviously, it's very hard for a kid to affect that, but as a coach, that's what I look for.
Your dad is an icon in the sport, 3-time NCAA champion, 48 Olympian, coached at Penn State. Was he a good parent for you?
He was a saintly man, as my mother. You know, there wasn't a dog or a cat or a child he wouldn't bring in, and he just, you know, he wouldn't. I mean, he never turned anybody aside, and we had no money growing up. I mean, I don't know what he made as a Penn State wrestling coach, full-time tenured professor, but it wasn't much. It was barely enough to put food on the table, but, you know, he never felt poor, and those weren't the important things. You know, I know he retired after missing my one brother's state championship because he didn't want to ever miss another state championship. He didn't want to ever be that guy. He is a hundred times better father and person than I ever wish I could be. So, yeah, I guess he was a good guy.
He fought in World War II. Did he ever tell stories about what it was like to be in World War II? I think he was on the beaches of Normandy, and I think maybe even D-Day. Did he talk about that?
Yeah, he was a combat engineer with, I think, 147th. They had 35% casualties in his battalion. It was pretty horrible. But he never talked about it, never spoke about it, never bragged about it, never, you know, until the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And then he went back with Andy Motter's father. They went back to the beachhead that they had been on. And then he came back and he was just, never stopped talking about it. Must have been a very cathartic experience. But then he told me some stories about how he would have to, you know, after the battle, he had to clean up the beaches for the photo ops. And when you realize what his definition of clean up the beach was, you realize why he wouldn't want to talk about this, because it wasn't cleaning up soda bottles and candy wrappers. You're cleaning up arms and legs and heads and faces. You know, he talked about being strafed by Messerschmitt in the Battle of Bald. I mean, so just very, very vivid memories, which, you know, he would never talk about. And you know, why would you want to talk about that? But then he went back and it was pretty interesting. And I grew up being a, you know, I guess some of those experiences, they were manifesting themselves through his passion through history and going through the old World War, the Civil War battlefields and the PBS black and white shows. We used to always war shows, documentaries we used to watch. And so I kind of through symbiosis, I guess, or osmosis, and maybe he was putting his passion kind of fell upon me. Cause I hated it at the time, trudging up, Lookout Mountain or, you know, any of these, you know, Gettysburg and at the near 6 and 6 to 11 years old, that's not what you want to do. But to this day, I love the strategies and all the kind of nuances of the military planning because of his passion. So I guess it was hidden in there for a long time. And when it came, and it finally did come out, and I still have his Bronze Star. So I do have some of his relics. That's about the only thing he kept.
Will you do me a favor? Will you tell us the story again about your first time wrestling at the West Gym at Northern Iowa? You've told it before, but I want to keep this tradition alive of you telling that great story.
Well, it's a great story for what you and I fans. That's a great story for me. I don't know if I was undefeated. I was close to undefeated. I was ranked third in the country as a freshman, true freshman. And Coach Lamb decided to make me the captain at West Gym. And my father had driven out. I think he was on the bench. They brought him to the bench. And Northern Iowa brought out a guy named Lou Sondergraf. So Lou, if you're out there, I hate you. He had just gotten out of the, I think he was on the Marines or the Navy. He had a tattoo before they had tattoos. And back then, you know, you're wrestling a guy with a tattoo, that's like 3 points for the other guy. And I was 19 years old. I didn't have a chest hair on my chest. I look, and this guy is bumping up a weight class to wrestle me nonetheless. I was sucked down to 50. I was dying. And I was winning the match for almost the entire match. And I just gasped like I've never gasped before. And he beats me at the end. Not only just beats me, but he rides me. I was humiliated. I'm like, who the heck is this guy? He ends up being an All-American that year, by the way, at 42. So he was pretty darn tough, but he was just a tough, hard-nosed Iowa, typical Northern Iowa wrestler. And I'm sitting at the bench, feeling sorry for myself. My dad comes up, puts his arm around me. He goes, "Rob, just want you know how proud I am of you." I go, "Why is that?" He goes, "You've done something that no other Cole has ever done in the West gym." And I go, "What's that?" He goes, "You lost!" He started laughing, started cackling he thought that was just the funniest thing ever. So he had a good perspective on life, and it kind of made me laugh. And this is that it's I look back at to this day and fondly remember that experience. And I tell my wrestlers that when you look back and on your memories, it's not always your victories that you're most fondly remember. It's things that impact you the most profoundly that you look back and you I don't regret losing that match now. It's because I would not have had that experience. So it's kind of ironic that I look back at that so favorably, and yet it should be in theory a negative experience, but it's not.
Well, you have a son, William Cole, that's wrestling for you right now. What's that been like coaching your son?
William's doing great. I'm really proud of him. He's wrestling up a weight class. Weighs about 150 pounds soaking wet. but we got a guy at 41 who's pretty good right now. That's Yanni Yakmahalis. And he ain't beating out. Yeah, not beating out Yanni. So if he were down at 41, he'd be enjoying an even better year. But he's close to that top. He's in some of the rankings. So he's even more impressive, he's a 385, 39 physics engineer, which is the toughest program at Cornell. I don't know where he didn't get it from me. I can assure you that. His mother's family is a long line of engineers. So, That for me, it'd be like locking me in hell and throwing away the key, putting me in the engineering department. But he's just a great kid overall. I've never had, and then my youngest is going to the state tournament this weekend, and will be attending Cornell next year as well. So I've done well in that department.
Rob, you mentioned Yanni. When was the first time you heard about him? When's the first time you saw him? And what has it been like coaching him to this point?
Oh, I've known Yanni since he's always. The expression "need a head of grasshopper." He would come up to a little clinics or camps that we had. I saw this little guy and I'm like, he's not bad. and then I got to know his dad. We became pretty good friends. And so, but even then we had Nick Arruja wrestling for us, and Nick's little brother, Vito Arruja, was wrestling Yanni in the state finals as an eighth grader. So of course I'm cheering for Vito over Yanni, and Yanni beats him in double or triple overtime. And that was Vito's only loss in high school, and then would have gone on and been a 5-time state champion, but if it weren't for Yanni. Now, of course, Yanni and Vito are best friends, and they live together. And next year, Vito will be joining the team, so that'll add a little bit of firepower to our program.
Rob, you've talked about the memories and the family atmosphere that Cornell has, and you've actually lost a couple important people, Adam Fry being one of those, and then Troy Nickerson's dad actually passed away shortly after Troy won his NCAA championship. When you have something like that in the Cornell family, how do you just face that? How do you kind of compartmentalize what happens with death, which comes to all of us, but you've had it with Cornell wrestling. How have you compartmentalized that?
Well, I've had it more, unfortunately. We had more than that. We had Graham Morin. My first years had a heart attack. Graham Morin was a 4-time Washington State champion. He had a heart attack in our room. Literally had a heart attack in our room. He had the Lenny Bias enlarged heart syndrome, and that was without doubt the hardest one. You have a teammate literally pass away in front of your friends. That was a pretty tough one, obviously. Adam, the kids had time to prepare themselves for that. We got another boy. I had another boy who just graduated, who got hit by a car. We had a boy who was coming in who Willie Jones, who got shot in a drive-by shooting the day before he was supposed to come to Cornell. So over 29 years, and there's boys who have fallen and we've lost seven. I mean, really young kids. And that's one of the things we tell the kids right from day one. There is a high likelihood that over the next 4 years, you're going to lose someone. Someone is going to lose a mother, a father, a friend, a teammate, or it's almost certainly going to happen.
I said, the one thing that doesn't change is the team is going to be there for you. And consistency and routine is very, very important. And when we have those situations, that's what we do. We wrestle. You know, you stay to your pattern and you stay with your friends. And this is going to sound horrible, but you're going to find that 18 to 22 year old kids tend to be very, very selfish. And I don't mean that in a negative that comes across, but that's the reality. You hear, oh, you'll never get over this. These horrific shootings we hear. Oh, you'll never get over it. Like, well, you know what? The reality is life goes on. Tragedies occur. And what I love about wrestling is, in a much less minor sense, you deal with that a terrible tragedy every time you lose because it's so impersonal. And so I think wrestlers tend to be a little bit more prepared in some way, twisted sense, for calamity because of all the sacrifice and all the hardship you endure through the sport. And that's really the only way that I deal with it is it's not the kids that I worry about. It's not me. It's the ones I feel bad for are the parents. Every one of the parents to this day, I would say, are not over that tragedy. The kids get to move on. They're too busy. And their mind is flooded with other things to worry about. But mom and dad are not. And those are the ones who are really most crestfallen.
Rob, we love to play games on this show, on the mat. We have a series of three games. We're actually going to put you through a game called the name game. I'm going to give you five names of someone or something, and I want you to just tell me what you think about this person or the something. Are you ready to play the name game?
Go for it.
All right, number one name, Dylan Palacio.
Oh, Dylan. I just saw Dylan this weekend. He's still out of his mind. I love the kid. I love that delusional, crazy son of a gun. I don't know if he's in real. I don't know what reality he's in. I hope everything I see on Facebook and Instagram is true. And if it is, I'm going to be hitting him up for some big money here real soon.
All right. Name number two, Travis Lee.
But to his defense. As much angst as he brought me a great deal of joy as well. Okay. And I tease him mercilessly, but he also was the kind of guy when push came to shove, there's one guy you want on the mat wearing a Cornell singlet, it was him. So that was more than his saving grace. And I have a soft spot in my heart for him.
Name number two, Travis Lee.
Travis Lee. Probably the toughest wrestler we've ever had. Just pure desire and carnal instinct. I mean, this kid you'd see his motor get going about halfway through the second period, and it just didn't pipe down. I feel bad. Travis is one guy who just didn't reach his goals because of injuries. He had a neck problem and the doctor said no more. And he would have been one I feel almost certain would have made the Olympic team and who knows how far he would have gone.
All right.
Toughest guy ever, but probably the toughest guy ever coached.
Name number three, Dave Schultz.
Without doubt, I learned more from Dave Schultz than all my other coaches combined, as far as freestyle technique, probably collegiate technique, encyclopedia of wrestling. And almost every area of my wrestling, I reference Dave Schultz. He brought me. I was on a trip with Dave, and the first time I traveled with Dave, we went over to Moscow. And I remember we won ice skates, or we won for wrestling in a dual meet. They gave us ice skates. They didn't fit, but that's what they made in that town. So that's what the gift was. And we were jet lagged. We were leaving that next day, and we decided to go ice skating. And it was 2 or 3 in the morning, maybe 4 in the morning. And I vividly remember Red Square in the distance. And we were on this little reservoir and we were ice skating, trying to ice skate, just me and Dave. And the snow started falling and it was like this charcoal snow because it was so polluted. And the police came and tried to arrest us. And thank God Dave spoke Russian because they're like, what the hell is going on? Why are you ice skating? We couldn't sleep. And we had these ice skates and we knew
we're going to bring them back home to the United States. We don't throw away. We don't want to waste not using them. And he got us out of the gulag. That was the last time I went up. The last time I was with Dave, but one of my most favorite memories with Dave.
All right. Great, great stories there. Name number four, someone you referenced already, Brian Smith.
Brian Smith, the most underrated coach in the United States of America, does not get the recognition he deserves. And probably because he wasn't a great wrestler, you know, as far as when I say great, I mean Olympic champion, national champion, tough as heck, but incredibly creative, organized, hardworking. And, as I said, I mean, there's some great coaches out there, but none get overlooked more than Brian.
All right. The final name is not a name of a person. It's the name of a group. University of Iowa wrestling fans.
Oh, I wish I had some. You know, they're all, I mean, look, I give them grief and bust their chops, but at the end of the day, I wish I had 10,000. I wish I had 20,000 just like them. You know, I mean, look, and it's funny because these guys, and I've seen the forums where they, you know, what if I give them a little grief over a match or whatever, a couple of years ago, they were, you know, of course they hate me. I'm the biggest jerk in the world. They don't realize, hey, I was conceived in Iowa. I'm one of them, you know, you know, as soon as the match is over, if you're out at a restaurant or a bar, you know, they're the first one to buy you a drink. So I hate to admit it, but I got a soft spot in my heart for them. Now, when we wrestle, if I would ever wrestle us, and we tried to get them on the schedule, but they don't want to wrestle because they don't want to have another tough team on their schedule. And I understand why. They got the Big Ten schedule. I'll do something to make them hate me again.
All right, you're out of the name game. We just want to follow up with a couple final questions here. Ben Darmstadt, I mean, what a unique guy this is. 6'3", I think, 197. What's his progression been like this freshman year?
Well, he got beat the first tournament. He was weighing about 195 pounds now. Now he's weighing about 210. That might not sound like a huge difference, but if you look at it as a percentage of size, I mean, that's pretty significant. He's finally put on the weight. He's only going to get bigger and stronger. I'd love to get him up to 220 in the summer if we could, and then he's going to be unbeatable. He's close to that now. His upward potential is limitless. And I think I know we've only seen the beginning of Ben, and he's just such a prolific pinner. We've got a couple of guys like that, you know, and I know Cornell is not really, people aren't really looking at us as a mix this year to win it, but with the cast of characters we have, who are all young and all back the next couple of years, I think that, people will start mentioning Cornell a little bit more.
Rob, you got a couple of guys on your roster from Alabama, including All-American Brandon Womack. And I think Alabama had its first Fargo champ in the summer. What kind of progression are you seeing out of that state?
So it's not just Alabama. You look at Arkansas. I think Arkansas is like 62 Division One, 62 Division. I'm sorry, 62 high school teams now. They didn't even have a high school team a couple of years ago, and of course they're. I don't want to insult Alabama for comparing them to Arkansas or vice versa. I know they're different states, but I think Arkansas has five college programs, which is remarkable. Now Alabama needs the same type of programs. Why don't they have some college programs? As I said, there's some great wrestling there. There's some great younger kids coming up out of Alabama. But that's the next step. We don't want a guy like Brandon Womack to have to go to Cornell to wrestle. Hopefully, you know, we can get a few college programs started there and ideally some Division One. I'm optimistic what Mike Moyer has been doing with the NWCA. I think they have 20, I think they've added 20, or we'll have added at least 20 20 college programs this year, of which there's at least one, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see a couple more by the end of the year. It's just remarkable what the NWCA has been doing. They don't get enough attention, and it's not free. You know, what they're doing and how they're doing it is tough because it takes, you know, these programs are being added, but what Mike's been doing is getting them a mat, getting them singlets. And with that, you know, it's $10,000, $15,000 every single time they do that. 20 times 15, you can do the math. It's really tough on them. But you know, for $10,000 or $15,000 at a program, it's just a remarkable buy. That's how you build the sport. You build the sport by adding college programs where now those kids are going, graduating, becoming high school teachers, coaching the sport, getting kids out for the program. You look at the decline in wrestling at the high school level. If you want to curb that, the easiest way to do that is to add more coaches, more high school coaches who are now going out and building programs. And I think that you're going to see a huge resurgence of the sport as all these teams are producing college, high school and junior high coaches in the next 15 to 20 years. It took us a while to get to this point, and now we've really figured out how to fix it. And now Mike has added Presbyterian, or helped add Presbyterian College, which is a Division I school. I believe you're going to see, you know, announcements sooner than later about a couple more Division I programs. They cost more to start up. So they're not 150, they're not 110,000 or 15,000. You know, they're $500,000 plus, but it's still, you know, a remarkable buy. I mean, what other sport is adding 20 sports a year?
Rob, thanks for this time. We really appreciate you being on the mat and giving us your insight. We wish you all the best at the NCAA championships. The EIWAs are coming up, and appreciate the time here on our radio show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. That was Rob Cole, head wrestling coach at Cornell University, NCAA champion, also made a world team in 1990. A lot of fun there. Just a lot of content over the last 40 minutes there that Rob Cole gave us. A couple highlights for you, Andy, of what you learned from Rob Cole in that interview.
Man, I loved hearing this stuff about his father in World War II. I thought that was really fascinating.
Icon. I mean, yeah. Bill Cole, it's the Outstanding Wrestler Award. He's the first wrestler to win back-to-back Outstanding Wrestler Awards, won 3 NCAA championships, and it's neat that they have the Outstanding Wrestler Award named after Bill Cole. So a lot of family history there. I love that they named their son William Cole. So a lot of fun to talk with Rob. We're going to be back next week with another great guest. Always listen in. Always check out trackwrestling.com. For Andy Hamilton, I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
Is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.